This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Support for KUAF is provided by the Malco Cinema Razorback Theater, featuring the Met Opera Live in HD, presenting Siegfried on Saturday, November 5th at 11 a.m. Tickets and more information are available on the web at malco.com.
On this edition of Ozarks, a new strategy for recognizing and dealing with elder abuse. It's a strategy that includes local, state, and federal agencies. Plus, John Oates explains how his devotion to Delta Blues influence his latest CD, Mississippi Mile, and he'll talk about his concert tomorrow night at the York Bowl on Dixon Street in Fayetteville. And also, a history of hip-hop that's live tonight at the Smoke and Barrel. We'll have a preview later on this edition of Ozarks at Large.
But first, this fall, more than 23,000 students enrolled at the University of Arkansas, a record number. The growth, while highly lauded, has also brought with it several concerns about how the increase in the number of students on campus would affect campus staff and facilities. Ozarks at Large's Ithi Agnihotri-Madolkar attended the fall semester campus faculty meeting held yesterday on the University of Arkansas campus. The meeting hoped to address concerns and invite suggestions from campus faculty members regarding the unprecedented growth. The faculty members were first addressed by University of Arkansas Chancellor G. David Gerhart.
We are here really to talk about two things. Do we have a plan, and do we know what we're doing? There are some days that we do not know what we are doing. I will readily admit that to you, but we think we do, particularly on the growth issue. We are here to hear your concerns and to listen to what you have to say and to try to perhaps answer any issues that you may have.
The unprecedented growth witnessed by the University of Arkansas in the past few years was the main topic of discussion during the fall semester campus faculty meeting. University of Arkansas Chancellor Dr. G. David Gerhart addressed over 100 U of A faculty members during the meeting that was held yesterday at Giffel's Auditorium in the old main building on the campus. Dr. Gerhart was joined by Provost Dr. Sharon Gaber and the chair of the campus faculty, Dr. Timothy Kroll.
The question has come up, why are we growing and who said we need to grow?
According to Dr. Gerhart, the growth of the university or the increase in enrollment was listed as a goal in the TAP report, a document that hopes to provide transparency and accountability to the people of Arkansas. The TAP report was developed in 2009 by the Chancellor's Administrative Policy Council in association with members of the campus community. Dr. Gerhart said one of the main reasons why the university sought growth was to service the people of Arkansas. The state, except for West Virginia, has the lowest number of citizens with a bachelor's degree. The university hopes to provide increased opportunities to state residents by increasing enrollment. Another benefit of the unprecedented growth was that it helped hold down tuition increases.
If we did not have this income from increased number of students, we'd be in pretty serious shape right now. We have not had an increase in our state appropriation for almost 5 years. That's the general appropriation that we get for our budget, almost 5 years. In addition to that, we've had cutbacks to our budget of several million dollars because of what's been occurring with the economy. So we believe it's important to right-size ourselves, if you will. That's one of the reasons, holding down tuition increases.
Dr. Gerhart cited the Arkansas Scholarship Lottery as one of the reasons that may have led to the increase in the number of enrolled students at the University of Arkansas. He said the average debt of 50% of the students who have graduated from the university is close to $25,000. The lottery might help alleviate that and provide some relief. The chancellor also said that the University of Arkansas is gradually becoming the institution of first choice for many Arkansans and others beyond the state line. Another reason that led to the increase in numbers, according to him, was the efficiency of the university's enrollment staff. However, Dr. Gerhart made the careful observation that while the number of students has increased, the university has not compromised the quality of the students being admitted. The chancellor then discussed the elements that need to be in place for accommodating the growth.
Obviously, we've got to hire more faculty. We had a serious problem. We had not increased faculty. And as a matter of fact, there was some feeling that we had increased staff to the detriment of increasing faculty ranks. However, I think we have tried to reverse that trend. We will have added almost 50 new tenure-track faculty after this year. We've also made a commitment to add about 100 non-tenure-track faculty, and our hope is to continue to add faculty in the future. We know it's not enough. All I can say to you that it is a good faith effort on our part to add as many as we think we can afford.
The chancellor said the sources of income for the university are limited. The tuition and fee is several hundred dollars below what other institutions similar in size charge, and state support has continued to decline over the years. These factors have been critical in determining the university's ability to give raises. Dr. Gearhart said the university will be giving raises retroactively this year. In addition to increasing the number of faculty members in the university, upgrades and additions to several buildings on campus are also underway, including Hillside Auditorium, Bowl Walker Hall, Ozark Hall, Epley Building, a new fitness center in the Union, and a new technology center also in the Union. The university is also in the process of purchasing the Cato Springs Research Center, the site of research for some engineering departments. Another concern the chancellor addressed was the lack of classrooms and laboratories. He said, although no decisions have been made, the university is considering building a large yet inexpensive facility located on the close perimeter of the campus that might have a number of labs and classrooms.
So the chancellor's laid out really why we have been growing, how we have been growing, and what we've been doing. And part of the question is, okay, so what is the plan? The plan is to grow to 25,000 students, and then look and determine, do we want to continue to grow?
During the meeting, Provost Dr. Sharon Gaber pointed out the biggest challenge remains figuring out whether the university wants to grow, and if so, what needs to be done to accommodate the growth and not compromise the quality of students or facilities available to them.
We need to look at faculty, staff, classrooms, labs, dorms. We have already begun some spreadsheets looking into this to determine what it is we would need. Assuming we maintain current ratios, and I write here, for example, faculty to student ratios, or assuming current numbers of students consistently would live in the dorms, that sort of thing. We are running all of that information, and what it's clear is it will cost a fair amount of money to be able to maintain the quality we would like to have in place to be able to do it. The other part that Chancellor Gearhart mentioned is in terms of our students then, what is it we're saying and doing? We know right now that applications are up for next fall. If we don't think about what is it we're going to do to be able to shape the class.
Dr. Gaber said the university is considering defining qualities to be able to shape its freshman class, focusing on diversity and high-ability students from Arkansas and out of state. Chancellor Gearhart and Provost Gaber also addressed questions from faculty members regarding classroom size issues, the synergy between the university and area community colleges to support students, state higher education policies, the Fulbright College, online classrooms, and the salaries of graduate assistants. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Ithi Agnihotri Mudholkar.
Ozarks at Large's Ithi Agnihotri Mudholkar attended the fall semester campus faculty meeting that was held yesterday afternoon on the University of Arkansas campus. The meeting addressed faculty concerns and invited suggestions about the university's growth plan. You can hear more from that meeting online at ozarksatlarge.com. Thank you. According to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Administration on Aging, hundreds of thousands of elders are neglected, exploited, and even abused each year. Federal, state, and nonprofit agencies are collaborating on strategic interventions. Last month in Washington County, the Coordinated Response to Elder Abuse Training Effort, CREATE for short, brought together national experts with local law enforcement and advocacy groups. It was the first meeting of its kind in Arkansas, and Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich has this report.
Gwen Irvin McClarty has a big title, first of all. She's Program Administrator of the Older Americans Act Division of Aging and Adult Services, Arkansas Department of Human Services. She works with 8 different area agencies on aging in Arkansas. She organized the CREATE seminar held at the Washington County Sheriff's Annex Office on October 11th.
Well, CREATE stands for Coordinated Response to Elder Abuse Training Effort. Last year, we applied for a grant through Department of Justice, and the purpose of the grant is being able to recognize, address, investigate, and prosecute cases of elder abuse, neglect, and exploitation. So we looked at all of the numbers throughout the state and found out that Washington County has the second highest number of custody cases in the state of Arkansas.
Meaning, after Sebastian County, Washington County is the second highest incidence of reported elder abuse in the state. More than 50 representatives from Washington County law enforcement, prosecutor's office, victim advocacy, and elder community nonprofits attended the training.
The goals of their training were to identify what can and should be done to intervene in elder abuse cases, to understand agency roles and authority in responding to elder abuse matters, to identify system barriers to effectively collaborate in elder abuse cases, and to identify and encourage communication, coordination, and collaboration among organizations to enhance victim safety and promote offender accountability in elder abuse cases.
The day after the training, there was a coordinator community response meeting. A CREATE team was formed, which will meet at least once every 2 months, and it will be replicated around this state.
The first type of training is direct service workers, so that'll be anyone with an advocate setting or anyone with adult protective services. And then the other module of training is going to be geared towards law enforcement, and that will also include the sheriff's office, off the local police departments, as well as the prosecutor's office.
Sergeant Emily Augustine, assigned to the Tiny Town Division with the Washington County Sheriff's Department, is now part of the permanent CREATE team.
Yes, I am on the CREATE team, and our job will be to not only train law enforcement and others, but also to stay on top of the investigations themselves and make sure that, you know, these types of crimes are being investigated properly. So,
on occasion, she says, she conducts welfare calls on elderly residents, and it's hard, she says, but after participating in the training, she'll be better able to assess types of abuse which may be occurring.
Well, I think the training was good. It opens our eyes as law enforcement to other elements that we may have not looked for in the past, such as financial exploitation, different forms of neglect, things that we may have, you know, missed, you know, in the past at some point. And now with this new training, they'll be more trained in recognizing those types of crimes.
Nearly 10% of Washington County's residents are age 65 or older. Some are among the first wave of Americans who turned 65 this past January, part of a 77.6 million person surge of baby boomers, those born between 1946 and 1964, entering into old age. Women 85 and older are the fastest growing segment of this population and are the most vulnerable. That's why national, state, and local agencies and groups are preparing for the influx, like Ann Turner. She is Elder Victim Services and Advocacy Coordinator with the National Clearinghouse on Abuse in Later Life, associated with the Wisconsin Coalition for Domestic Violence. She was one of 2 trainers at the Washington County Coordinated Response to Elder Abuse Training Effort in October. She says there are common misconceptions regarding elder abuse.
Number one, that it only happens, I think what we hear a lot of, is that it's happening in nursing homes, but in actuality it's happening in their homes, in their personal homes. family members are often the primary perpetrators of the abuse. I think the other, you know, myth that we try to talk through with communities is that it's caused by caregiver stress, that somebody is providing care for a vulnerable adult and they get stressed out and then lash out by abusing them. When in all actuality, we really believe that it is caused by the similar power and control dynamics that we see in with younger domestic violence victims.
Experts say frail or even sick elders are abused, neglected, or exploited every year in both domestic and institutionalized settings. For example, last week, police arrested a Northwest Arkansas woman accused of stealing credit cards from an elder resident living in a retirement community where she worked, an example of financial exploitation.
Physical and sexual abuse is also going on in these homes. Power and control dynamics may be going on to get control of an elder's finances. Even self-neglect, something that we label as self-neglect, we're concerned about the elder neglecting themselves. We encourage communities to look a little deeper just to make sure that self-neglect isn't going on because somebody is, you know, taking their funds or using their funds for other things than the necessities of that elder's care.
Neglect by caregivers could also include lack of food, health care, or protection. Emotional abuse can also occur among family caregivers who inflict mental distress through acts of humiliation and intimidation. And abandonment is a form of abuse where vulnerable elders are chronically left alone to fend for themselves. So say your mom is a resident of an assisted living facility or is receiving home health care. What are the warning signs of abuse?
Well, I think, you know, often what we see in elder abuse cases, I think there may be repeated accidental, quote, accidental injuries that go on in an individual's life. And it's important to, you know, explore those a little deeper and not just assume that that is going on. You know, do the bruises and the injuries match what they are telling you has happened? The elder may hint that something is going on. They may not say it outright or, you know, may not know the language that we're comfortable with, such as the domestic violence movement where we can talk about domestic violence or abuse. So they may hint or use other language to talk about being afraid or that someone's being rough with them. Depression, you know, evidence of effects of stress and trauma, like chronic pain or chronic illnesses, those kind of things.
Another indication are caregivers who try to deceive, blaming elders as being difficult or clumsy. Ann Turner advises sequestering the elder away from a suspected abuser in order to determine what might be going on, especially family caregivers who are dependent on elders for financial support. The prevalence of elder abuse is only starting to emerge.
You know, there was a study done in 2009 that showed a prevalence of about 11% of elders had experienced that were interviewed on the telephone had experienced abuse within the last year.
Three-quarters perpetrated by family members, so-called domestic elder abuse. Turner's also pointed to a study conducted by the National Center on Elder Abuse about the lack of reporting.
84% of the abuse that is going on is not being reported to the system. So it really is an area that I'm not certain we know how prevalent it is out there. And I think as we do, you know, as communities give more attention to this issue, we will see a clearer understanding of what's going on.
Which proves the need for programs like the Coordinated Response to Elder Abuse Training Effort. But the question is, how can someone prey on an elder?
It's such a new field that I think we are just learning about some of the realities of what might be going on with these situations.
All 50 states, including Arkansas, have legislative enacted elder abuse prevention laws under Adult Protection Services. It's a federally funded program which investigates and intervenes in reports of abuse, neglect, and exploitation. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
For more information, visit the National Clearinghouse on Abuse Later in Life at ncall.us or the National Center on Elder Abuse at ncea.aoa.gov, or you can visit ozarksatlarge.com for the links.
That is music, by the way, from an ensemble known as the Mont Alto Motion Picture Orchestra. And they will be performing live tonight in Giffels Auditorium on the University of Arkansas campus. It's something they have done before. It's an orchestra that creates or recreates music, especially for silent films.
So they'll be playing a silent film?
They are. Tonight there is a film called The Silent Enemy that will be screened at Giffels Auditorium. It's the opening of the 18th Annual University of Arkansas Native American Symposium. The screening of The Silent Enemy, which is a 1930 film, is tonight. The Mont Alto Orchestra will be there playing live. It's in conjunction with the movie. It's something that if you lived in the teens, the 20s, or maybe the early 30s in a large metropolitan city, you've experienced. Most of us don't fall into that category.
No, I've never even, I don't know, I just never gave it a thought. I was telling you earlier, I know I've seen silent films, or bits of them, I should say, like on Turner Classic Movies, like late at night, and the music's on there, and it didn't occur to me that that was like added later?
Yes. Generally, when silent films, and I know this because I've interviewed Rodney Sauer from the Mont Alto Motion Picture Orchestra before.
Oh.
A motion picture would be shown in your theater, and theaters had accompanists, musicians or orchestras, and they would have scores often written specifically for the film, and they would be performed live. But obviously, when the film would arrive in town, it wouldn't have anything because it was a silent movie.
For some reason, I don't know why that never clicked with me. Because, I mean, I know when we went on our little Route 66 trip and we were in Miami at the Coleman Theater, you know, our tour guide was showing us the organ and was explaining how they just had somebody come in and they watched a film and he played live. And for some reason, it just never clicked with that was live. Like, obviously that was live. It was a silent film.
Right.
I don't know why.
Well, the Mont Alto Motion Picture is tonight in Giffels Auditorium. It begins at 7, and it's sponsored by the Honors Film Association and the Office of Admissions. It's worth your time if you've got some time tonight.
Do you have some time? Because I know you really like silent film.
I do. I'm going to try to make time.
You're going to try to make time? I thought you might.
Last night I went to Empty Bowls.
Yeah, how was that?
That was fantastic. It was at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Fayetteville, benefited Life Source.
And the idea is it's like a soup dinner, but they come in ceramic bowls that you get to take home. Is that the idea?
You don't have your soup in the bowls. The bowls are there. They've been created by area artists and art students, and the admission got you a chance to sample so many soups that were created by local restaurants, and then you took one bowl home. They were all different.
Okay.
And I grabbed a really neat yellow one.
A neat yellow one?
Yes.
I'll have to see this. Bring it for lunch. Bring it for lunch sometime.
Okay. There's more coming up on Ozarks at Large.
Yes, there is.
Not only will you hear a bit more music in between stories from the Mont Alto Motion Picture Orchestra, but we have a preview of tonight's History of Hip Hop at Smoke and Barrel.
Yes, I'm excited about this.
And John Oates performs live tomorrow night at UARC Bowl in Fayetteville. Talked to him yesterday. We also have Garrison Keillor in the Writer's Almanac and more ahead.
Earth, sky. Sea ice losses during 2011 were the second lowest in the satellite record. The record dates back to 1979. That's according to the official report by the National Snow and Ice Data Center, released in October.
Every year, Arctic sea ice undergoes a cycle of melting and freezing. The ice shrinks to its smallest extent in late summer and enlarges to its greatest extent in late winter.
Overall, Arctic sea ice has been declining since 1979 at about 10% to 12% per decade. The decline in sea ice is driven largely by warmer air and sea surface temperatures in the Arctic. Data prior to 1979, before satellite tracking, are less comprehensive, but shipping records suggest that Arctic sea ice has been in a continued state of decline for the last 100 years.
Sea ice in the Arctic acts as an air conditioner for Earth because the bright white ice reflects light and heat back to space. Scientists are concerned that a continued loss of sea ice could amplify global warming.
Current climate models forecast that the Arctic Ocean could lose almost all of its summer ice cover by 2100 or sooner.
National Snow and Ice Data Center Director Mark Cerise said, "We might be looking at an Arctic Ocean essentially free of summer ice only a few decades from now." Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. Tonight at Smoke and Barrel in Fayetteville, Eric Jensen, also known as DJ EJ, will host an event called Hip Hop History. It will feature 8 DJs, spinning first when hip hop began in the early 70s and ending with today's Dirty South style. Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas has more.
One more time.
You're listening to DJ EJ's.
DJ EJ's.
DJ EJ's.
DJ EJ's Wheel of Steel. Only on KXUA.
KXUA.
KXUA 88.3 FM.
Fayetteville,
you may
y'all.
Remember the sound Peace. Of Eric Jensen's voice from his show, DJ EJ's Wheels of Steel. It once aired on KXUA. He has since partnered with the Smoke and Barrel Tavern to bring audiences a live version of the radio show. Last month, they brought disco, the sound of the New York underground. This month, they are presenting hip-hop history. The first of eight local DJs will begin with the earliest hip-hop, the classic Beats and Breaks. According to Eric, hip-hop was born in the early 1970s.
In the Bronx, the Boogie Down Bronx. And it started 1520 Sedgwick, which is the address of a housing project. And that's where DJ Kool Herc, who was actually born in Jamaica and moved to the United States with his parents as a teenager, started throwing parties in the common room. You could rent the room in the housing project, and he would throw parties there. And then in the summer, he would throw them outside. And in the course of doing these parties, he would play all his favorite records. And he started to notice that at certain points in the record, the breakdown was when people would really start dancing. The vocals would drop out, and then we go down to the basic beat, and people would go wild and jump on the floor, and everybody would dance during that part. And so he thought, well, what if I could extend that breakdown, not just 30 seconds or 10 seconds, depending on the song, but extend it for minutes. And so he started choosing tracks and queuing up those parts of the record, fading in, fading out. He wasn't really a mixing DJ, but he would fade in and at those breaks and just go from one break to another. So the incredible Bongo Band, their song Apache was one of the four songs that he talks about doing this experiment with.
Some of the people that would go wild and dance were what became known as B-boys, the guys that were doing moves associated with hip-hop.
Later to be called hip-hop. It wasn't even called hip-hop, and at this time it was called wild style or breakin'. Or I'm going to that breakin' party, or I'm going to that wild style party.
Kool Herc, the father of hip-hop, is also credited with the creation of MCs.
These guys that would stand by him, and they would be on the mic, get the crowd going, you know, put your hands in the air, wave around like you just don't care. You know, these are all very early, guys getting that was the MC's job, get the party going, keep everybody excited. And so that also developed out of Kool Herc's parties. I could keep going with African Bambaataa, who really brought eclecticism to hip-hop. He joined some of these record pools, which were actually grew out of the disco movement, which was going on at the same time, and down in Manhattan. And you join the record pool, you get access to these records and stake your claim and get those records. And Africa Bambaataa, although not a disco DJ, but he did love disco, he joined these pools early on and got a hold of a lot of records, like Kraftwerk, which later influenced him doing Planet Rock, and which is the beginning of the electro-funk sound, a blending of hip-hop, German electronica, just all kinds of different styles together. And he would also, Africa Bambaataa would play stuff like the B-52s, disco, world, all kinds of stuff. And this led to a lot of samples in hip-hop being from places you never associate with hip-hop. Like, you never expected them to be listening to that in the Bronx at that time. And that's all because Bambaataa brought that stuff with him. And then Grandmaster Flash brought the technical aspects of DJing to hip-hop. He, unlike Kool Herc, he wanted to be able to continue these breaks on a beat and be able to fade in and fade out seamlessly and not notice that the song had changed, that the people would just keep dancing and suddenly realize after a few seconds, oh, this is a different song, but the beats were right on at the same tempo. And so he really worked at using his turntables.
He didn't actually have a mixer. Grandmaster Flash, being the technical whiz that he was, built his own crossfader and came up with his quick mix style.
Also, one of the first DJs to do body tricks where he'd turn around and spin behind his back and do all kinds of stuff while he was DJing.
Though those three men are credited with the creation of what is now known as hip-hop, the first rap record to be released was made by a female. In 1978, Sweet T, or Tanya, produced a track in her father's studio. It wasn't until the eve of the 80s that hip-hop really
I think very deeply.
In about 4 seconds, a teacher will be able to speak.
The Run-DMC label, as well as Run-DMC, were born in and dominated the 1980s. Eric refers to this time period as the golden age of the MC, where rhyming isn't just a simple cadence, but an excelled vocal delivery style.
And an example of that is KRS-One, My Philosophy, where he makes a lot of references back to the original, because he, as a kid, he ran away from home, or he left home at age 14 and was living in homeless shelter in the Bronx. He was born in Brooklyn, went to the Bronx, and he was exposed to the early hip-hop. He was, I think at first he wasn't old enough to go to DJ Kool Herc's parties, but he would listen, you know, get as close as he could and listen to it. And so he makes reference to the Bronx and where it all started. And of course, he also called his group Boogie Down Productions, which is a reference to the Boogie Down Bronx. Sucker MC had a response. You think we care? I know that they are on the tip. My posse from the
Bronx is thick. In real life, we roll correctly. The late 80s and into the early 90s is when L.A. and the West Coast sound began to take over.
Dr. Dre, along with DJ Quick, Warren G., and some others, really originated this sound. And basically what it was, or what it is they took slower tempo funk songs and sampled them. And funk songs that were bass and synth sound heavy, and created this real smooth kind of rapping style, like Snoop Dogg, you know, he's total West Coast G-Funk style, and just a very smooth, laid-back kind of approach. And The Chronic is probably the, you know, if you could boil it down to one album that really made the sound explode and become dominant in the 90s, it was that album. Death Row is the label that pays me. Unfadable, so please don't try to fake this. But back to the lecture at hand.
Perfection is perfected, so I'm a lad, I'm understanding. From a young Jesus. Today, hip-hop has gone south. Eric says the style of this and last decade is known as Dirty South crunk-style hip-hop, being created by artists such as Outkast and Lil Wayne. For tonight's event at Smoke and Barrel, DJ EJ will be emceeing, but he won't be spinning. He'll be celebrating his birthday. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas. Stop the rocker to the bang, bang, boogie. Say up, jump the boogie to the rhythm of the boogie to beat. Now what you hear is not a test. I'm rapping to the beat. And me, the groove, and my friends are gonna try to move your feet. You see, I am Wonder Mike, and I like to say hello. Up to the black, to the white, the red, and the brown, and the purple, and yellow. But first, I gotta bang, bang, the boogie to the boogie. Say up, jump the boogie to the bang, bang, boogie, let's rock.
Christina Thomas talked with Eric Jensen, who's also known as DJ EJ, about tonight's History of Hip Hop that's taking place at Smoke and Barrel on Dixon Street in Fayetteville. The event begins at 9:00. There is no cover charge.
It's Wednesday, November 2nd, 2011. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
And joining us now is Becca Bacon-Martin, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Sometimes I hate to give you like the music recommendations because I don't really speak music. So it means we have to trust Kevin Kinder, our music writer.
Trustworthy source.
Yes. And he says that you should go to George's Majestic Lounge on Wednesday, which is today.
Yes.
And you should go there at 9 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And you should hear a band being put together by Chris Robinson, who was with the Black Crowes.
Oh, really?
Huh.
The new group is called the Chris Robinson Brotherhood.
Mm-hmm.
And it is described on its Facebook page as psychedelic filling in a folk blues pie.
I love fans' descriptions of themselves.
Yeah,
They link together adjectives in a way that I don't think most people would think of. And I'm not sure that anybody really knows what they mean.
Remember, I used to hang out with a band called Vessels of Wrath.
Yes, ma'am.
I understand that part of the PR.
Mm-hmm.
Tickets are $18. Go have fun.
I'd say call ahead because this is the sort of thing at George's
that
will sell well.
Yeah.
It's going to fill up fast.
Yep. Becca Bacon-Martin is the features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Sometimes it feels like the road is my home. And I've been living on.
That's the title song from the CD Mississippi Mile, the third solo record from John Oates. Oates, who, as half of the duo Hall & Oates, embraced the soul, R&B, and doo-wop of his youth, now channels the influence of the Mississippi Delta on American music.
Long haul, man.
Tomorrow night, John Oates will deliver his passion for folk, roots, and blues music on stage at the UARC Bowl in Fayetteville. His new CD includes originals and reimagined blues and rock and roll classics. He covers Elvis, Lieber and Stoller, Percy Mayfield, what he calls a musical autobiography of his taste.
Of all the things that mattered to me as a kid, growing up, learning how to play the guitar and singing and the stuff that turned me on, really, as a kid, to be a musician and want to do this. And so, I'm obviously it could have been a triple, quadruple album, but I just picked the touchstones of the things that really felt right to me. Felt like, hey, if you combine a little bit of Curtis Mayfield with a little Chuck Berry and a little Elvis and a little Mississippi John Hurt, that's kind of where I'm coming from.
Well, it's all right. It's all right. Say it's all right. Have a good time. It's all right. Whoa, it's all right. You got to move slow.
The CD was recorded in Nashville, and John Oates says he was looking for a certain kind of recording experience, one that did away with what he calls paralysis by analysis. He wanted to grab some of the best musicians in Nashville that he could find, friends like Sam Bush, Becca Bramlett, and Mike Henderson. Then, as an ensemble, they could play music they've loved for years and see what happens. He wanted a professional but loose atmosphere in the studio.
Loose is exactly the correct word to use. tight and loose at the same time. And by that I mean the approach was loose, but the playing is tight because the musicians are so darn good. When you take people like Jerry Douglas and Sam Bush and Becca Bramlett and Mike Henderson, you put them in a room together, the playing is going to be superlative. That's just what you get when you get these incredible players together. What we did was we recorded in a very original old style. We got together, we sat in a circle, we looked at each other, and we roughed out the arrangements in our head, really, and then we just played.
He says there were no more than one or two takes recorded for each song and sparse overdub work on any of the album. Spontaneity was encouraged and led to one of the originals that John Oates wrote for the CD. He says he was determined to cover a song by one of his favorite songwriters, Doc Watson, And since the recording session was taking place just about a month after last year's devastating flood in Nashville, the Watson classic Deep River Blues seemed a natural nominee. But the version John Oates says he was working up in the studio was, in his words, just mediocre and not worth recording.
And I said, man, you know, we're never gonna top this, you know, the Doc Watson version of this. Why bother?
Slowly, though, a collaboration began inside the studio as musicians stretched Doc Watson's chords and Oates began filling in with some lyrics. And things began to gel.
I thought about it and I said, man, Deep River Blues, Deep River, the Nashville flood, it all seemed to make sense to me. And then, you know, and then after having done it, of course, I wrote a song about the Nashville flood. And then I said, you know what, interestingly enough, this is kind of like a microcosm of how American pop music and rock and roll evolved from the blues. You know, from an original song, people took the idea and changed it and adapted it and morphed it into something else.
Clouds come on Sunday morning, the thunder rolls and the rain keep a pouring down, down Deep River. Oh, it'll sanctify and wash it clean. Dirty waters will cruise over me.
The CD, Mississippi Mile, is a sincere but fun salute to the music of John Oates' youth. And, he says, when considering the songs of his youth, that could certainly include a chance for John Oates to cover John Oates.
What I want, you got, and it might be hard to handle. Like a flame that burns a candle. The candle feeds the flame.
I was playing a blues riff just in between takes, and I started singing You Make My Dreams Come True, just as almost kind of as a joke. And everybody liked it, and they put this Texas swing feel behind it. And I thought, man, now that I would have never in a million years imposed this Texas swing feel on that 80s pop song. But, you know, what it does, I think it just shows that it's just a good song, and a good song can be interpreted and done in a lot of different ways, so that's pretty cool.
On a night when bad dreams become a screamer, when I'm messing with a dreamer.
John Oates will play tomorrow night at the UARC Bowl beginning at 8 o'clock. Doors will open at 7. More information can be found online at uarcballroom.com. John Oates' new CD is titled Mississippi Mile, and you can learn more about him at johnoates.com. This is Ozarks at Large. And it's time now for a question. And winners today... You know what? We're going to have two winners today.
Okay.
And both will win a pair of tickets for the Saturday, November 5th performance at the Eureka Springs City Auditorium. It's part of the Eureka Springs Folk Festival.
All right.
And this concert, it's quite the lineup.
Mm-hmm. We have Still on the Hill, Three Penny Acre, and Split Lip Rayfield.
That's right. So you will have a pair of tickets if you win today. Now, today's question deals with art, Crystal Bridges, and a little bit with Hall & Oates.
Okay.
If you know where Hall & Oates, Daryl Hall and John Oates, met as young men and formed their duo, if you know what city they were in, you already know the answer to the question.
Okay.
The question is, at least three artists who will be featured in the Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art Collection hail from this city. Oh. Alexander Calder, Mary Cassatt, and Andrew Wyeth. All at least spent some time or were born in this city. Is that city New York, Philadelphia, or San Francisco?
If you know or have a guess, give us a call at 800-522-5823. That's 800-522-KUAF.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 2nd of November, 2011. It was on this date, 1920, the first modern commercially licensed radio station began broadcasting. It was KDKA in Pittsburgh, the Westinghouse Electric and Manufacturing Company, who had an employee named Frank Conrad. He dropped out of school in the seventh grade, but he had a lot of ideas, and he built his own radio station in suburban Wilkinsburg, Pennsylvania, and played some phonograph records, hired his own sons as announcers, and when wireless sets were made available for sale, people snapped them up. No one had ever thought of making radio available to the average person. But Westinghouse smelled an opportunity to manufacture wireless sets and sell them and generate demand by creating radio stations. So they built a powerful transmitter in Pittsburgh, and at 8 o'clock in the evening on November the 2nd, Leo Rosenberg opened the first broadcast, saying, "This is KDKA of the Westinghouse Electric and Manufacturing Company in East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We shall now broadcast the election returns, the presidential election between Harding and Cox." It's the anniversary of the first and only flight of the largest airplane ever built, made of birch, designed by Howard Hughes, who was at the controls on this day in 1947 in Long Beach, California. He reached an altitude of about 70 feet, went over a mile, never flew the plane again. And it's the birthday of cheerleading, 1898, the University of Minnesota, the first time that Yale leaders got out of the crowd, went down to the field, picked up a megaphone, faced the crowd, and whipped them into a frenzy, yelling, "Rah, rah, rah, sky you ma, hoorah, hoorah, varsity, varsity, Minnesota." Here's a poem for today by Walt MacDonald, "Marriage is a Bungee Jump." Marriage is a bungee jump off some box canyon in Colorado, concession manned by a minion from the 50s, high on weed, beard he hadn't brushed since high school. The ropes felt new enough, and he swore he measured them, the fall to the rocks, a lover's leap, 80 stories long. He made a sign, a waiver, and pay in cash. Folding the bills away, he slouched back to the shack and high-fived a friend who passed the bottle bag. "Done it again, like Cupid. We heard a match strike, the sizzle of hemp. We checked the ropes, the stiff knots tied by someone who flunked that lesson in scouts. We checked the charts, the geology of cliffs and canyons, but no one knows which fibers split, which granite ledges crack. On the edge of hope for nothing we'd ever done, we tugged at the ropes, both ropes, blessing the stretch and strain with our bodies, a long time falling to the pain and certainty of stop. Hand in hand, we stepped up, wavering to the ledge, hearing the gush of a river we leaped to, a far-off cawing crow, the primitive breeze of the fall, and squeezed, clinging to each other's vows, that only death could separate us now." A poem by Walt MacDonald, "Marriage is a Bungee Jump," from "Blessings the Body Gave," published by Ohio State University Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, where your mobile device can turn into a virtual poetry library with the Poetry Foundation's poetry app. You can find it online at poetryfoundation.org. And by Constant Contact, helping small businesses use email marketing with social media to reach more customers in more places, online at constantcontact.com. Edited by Noah Smith, written by Holly Vanderhaar. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Time now for the answer to our question today. Two winners will be selected from all the correct answers, and the winners will each receive a pair of tickets to the Still on the Hill, Three Penny Acre, and Split Lip Rayfield Split Bill Saturday night at the Odd in downtown Eureka Springs, part of the Eureka Springs Folk Festival that's going on this weekend.
All right, and remind people what they had to know the answer to.
at least three artists who are included in the Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art Collection, Alexander Calder, Mary Cassatt, and Andrew Wyeth, hail from the same city. Mm-hmm. It's also the city where Hall & Oates met as young men. Was that city New York, Philadelphia, or San Francisco?
I'm just going to guess. San Francisco?
No. Philadelphia.
Really?
Yes. Philadelphia, one of the most artistic cities in the U.S. Painter Thomas Sully is from Philadelphia. Thomas Eakins is from Philadelphia. The sculptor Ginger Gilmore from there. Also, Martin O'Dell, who created the Green Lantern.
Well,
calls
there
Philadelphia
you go.
Home. All right. We'll pick some winners soon.
Support for KUAF comes from YouthBridge, announcing their texting campaign, which begins tomorrow, November 3rd. This campaign will help to fund residential, clinical, medical, and family counseling programs to help area youth. More information regarding Text Youth to 2222 is available on the web at youthbridge.com.
And the country's longest continuously running folk festival, the 64th anniversary of the Eureka Springs Folk Festival, is already begun. It runs through the 5th. Events include competitions and art shows. Friday night, the Barefoot Ball with music by the Hog Scalders and Big Smith. Saturday, of course, at the auditorium, it's Split Lip Rayfield, Three Penny Acre, Still on the Hill. For more information about all of the things going on, OzarkFolkFestival.com. And I should also remind you that tomorrow night, live music all over the place.
I know.
Fulbright Trio, Eugene Kong on violin, Stephen Gates cello, and Mei Shun Hong on piano. Their second concert of the season that takes place tomorrow night at 7:30 inside the Stella Boyle Smith Concert Hall. That's in the Fine Arts Center of the U of A. It's free, and it will be followed by a reception. Everybody's invited.
Wait, so I have a question. Barefoot ball? Can I go barefoot?
Yes. The barefoot ball goes back. There was a program called Truth or Consequences.
Uh-huh.
It was a radio program hosted by Ralph Edwards, then later Bob Barker. Long before he did
Price is Right,
he did this syndicated show called Truth or Consequences.
Okay.
It was sort of a beat the clock idea.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have something, and if you could achieve this goal or win this game, you'd win a prize.
Mm-hmm.
And one time, the prize was to go to Eureka Springs. This was a national program, but the winning couple got to go to Eureka Springs. And they played up the whole hillbilly motif, and so there was this barefoot ball.
Oh.
And so for a while, and folks in Eureka Springs know more about this than I do, so I'm kind of talking off the cuff. I might be getting a few things wrong. But for a while, they would have the annual barefoot ball. It went away for a while.
Uh-huh.
Now they have brought it back. So the barefoot ball, and you are encouraged to go sans socks and shoes.
Oh, I love it. Okay, that makes me very happy.
Okay. So that's the barefoot ball. That happens Friday night.
Good. A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Liberty.
Where is Liberty, Arkansas?
It is south of Mansfield.
All right. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
We'll end with more music from the Mont Alto Motion Picture Orchestra. They perform tonight in Gibbles Auditorium. It's free and open to the public. Have a great Wednesday.